and he seemed to feel the prayers lasting more than 3 minutes were showing off. God was always unoccupied in Finney's universe, ready to lend an ear any time at all. Anyone who failed to get his message through in 3 minutes, as I sometimes failed to do when trying to impress him, Phineas, with my sanctity, wasn't trying. He was still talking when I fell asleep, and the next morning, through the icy atmosphere which one window raised an inch had admitted to our room, he woke me with the over-indignant shout, "What is all this crap about no maids?" He was sitting up in bed, as though ready to spring out of it, totally and energetically awake. I had to laugh at this indignant athlete with the strength of 5 people complaining about the service. He threw back his bedclothes and said, "Hand me my crutches, will you?" Until now, in spite of everything, I had welcomed each new day as though it were a new life, where all past failures and problems were erased, and all future possibilities and joys open and available, to be achieved probably before night fell again. Now, in this winter of snow and crutches with Phineas, I began to know that each morning reasserted the problems of the night before, that sleep suspended all, but changed nothing, that you couldn't make yourself over between dawn and dusk. Phineas, however, didn't believe this. I'm sure that he looked down at his leg every morning first thing, as soon as he remembered it, to see if it had not been totally restored while he slept. When he found on this first morning back at Devon that it happened still to be crippled and in a cast, he said in his usual, self-contained way, "Hand me my crutches, will you?" Brinker Hadley, next door, always woke like an express train. There was a gathering rumble through the wall, as Brinker reared up in bed, coughed hoarsely, slammed his feet on the floor, pounded through the freezing air to the closet for something in the way of clothes, and thundered down the hall to the bathroom. Today, however, he veered and broke into our room instead. "Ready to sign up?" he shouted before he was through the door. "You ready to en-" "Finney!"
"You ready to en- what?"
pursued Finney from his bed.
"Who's ready to sign an en- what?"
"Finney, by God, you're back!"
"Sure,"
confirmed Finney with a slight pleased grin.
"So," Brinker curled his lip at me, "your little plot didn't work so well after all."
"What's he talking about?"
said Finney as I thrust his crutches beneath his shoulders.
"Just talking," I said shortly. "What does Brinker ever talk about?"
"You know what I'm talking about well enough."
"No, I don't."
"Oh, yes, you do."
"Are you telling me what I know?"
"Damn right I am."
"What's he talking about?"
said Finney. The room was bitterly cold. I stood trembling in front of Phineas, still holding his crutches in place, unable to turn and face Brinker, and this joke he had gotten into his head, this catastrophic joke. "He wants to know if I'll sign up with him," I said.
"Enlist?"
It was the ultimate question for all 17-year-olds that year, and it drove Brinker's insinuations from every mind but mine.
"Yeah,"
said Brinker.
"Enlist?"
cried Finney at the same time. His large and clear eyes turned with an odd expression on me. I had never seen such a look in them before. After looking at me closely, he said,
"You're going to enlist?"
"Well, I just thought..."
"Last night, after the railroad work..."
"You thought you might sign up,"
he went on, looking carefully away. Brinker drew one of his deep, senatorial breaths, but he found nothing to say. We three stood shivering in the thin New Hampshire morning light, Finney and I in pajamas, Brinker in a blue flannel bathrobe and ripped moccasins.
"When will you?"
Finney went on.
"Oh, I don't know,"
I said.
"It was just something Brinker happened to say last night, that's all."
"I said,"
Brinker began in an unusually guarded voice, glancing quickly at Phineas.
"I said something about enlisting today."
Finney hobbled over to the dresser and took up his soap dish.
"I'm first in the shower,"
he said.
"You can't get that cast wet, can you?"
asked Brinker.
"No. I'll keep it outside the curtain."
"I'll help,"
said Brinker.
"No,"
said Finney without looking at him.
I can manage all right.
How can you manage all right? Brinker persisted aggressively.
I can manage all right,
Finney repeated with a set face.
I could hardly believe it, but it was too plainly printed in the close expression of his face to mistake, too discernible beneath the even tone of his voice. Phineas was shocked at the idea of my leaving. In some way, he needed me. He needed me. I was the least trustworthy person he had ever met. I knew that. He knew, or should know that, too. I had even told him. I had told him. But there was no mistaking the shield of remoteness in his face and voice. He wanted me around. The war then passed away from me, and dreams of enlistment and escape and a clean start lost their meaning for me.
Sure, you can manage the shower all right, I said. But what difference does it make? Come on, Brinker's always getting there first. Enlist? What a nutty idea. That's just Brinker wanting to get there first again. I wouldn't enlist with you if you were General MacArthur's eldest son.
Brinker reared back arrogantly. And who do you think I am?
But Finney hadn't heard that. His face had broken into a wide and dazzled smile at what I had said, lighting up his whole face.
Enlist? I drove on. I wouldn't enlist with you if you were Elliot Roosevelt.
First cousin, said Brinker over his chin, once removed.
He wouldn't enlist with you, Finney plunged in, if you were Madam Chiang Kai-shek.
Well, I qualified in an undertone. He really is Madam Chiang Kai-shek.
Well, fan my brow, cried Finney,
giving us his stunned look of total, appalled, horrified amazement.
Who would have thought that? Chinese! The Yellow Peril! Right here at Devon!
And as far as the history of the class of 1943 at the Devon School was concerned, this was the only part of our conversation worth preserving. Brinker Hadley had been tagged with a nickname at last, after 4 years of creating them for others and eluding one himself. Yellow Peril Hadley swept through the school with the speed of a flu epidemic, and it must be said to his credit that Brinker took it well enough, except when, in its inevitable abbreviation, people sometimes called him Yellow instead of Peril. But in a week, I had forgotten that. And I have never since forgotten the dazed look on Finney's face when he thought that on the first day of his return to Devon, I was going to desert him. I didn't know why he had chosen me, why it was only to me that he could show his most humbling sides of his handicap. I didn't care, for the war was no longer eroding the peaceful summertime stillness I had prized so much at Devon. And although the playing fields were crusted under a foot of congealed snow, and the river was now a hard gray-white lane of ice between gaunt trees, peace had come back to Devon for me. So the war swept over like a wave at the seashore, gathering power and size as it bore on us, overwhelming in its rush, seemingly inescapable, and then, at the last moment, eluded by a word from Phineas. I had simply ducked. That was all. And the wave's concentrated power had hurtled harmlessly overhead, no doubt throwing others roughly up on the beach, but leaving me peaceably treading water as before. I did not stop to think that one wave is inevitably followed by another even larger and more powerful when the tide is coming in.
I like the winter.
Finney assured me for the fourth time as we came back from chapel that morning.
Well, it doesn't like you.
Wooden plank walks had been placed on many of the school's paths for better footing, but there were icy patches everywhere on them. A crutch misplaced and he could be thrown down upon the frozen wooden planking or into the ice-encrusted snow. Even indoors, Devon was a nest of traps for him. The school had been largely rebuilt with a massive bequest from an oil family some years before in a peculiar style of Puritan grandeur, as though Versailles had been modified for the needs of a Sunday school. This opulent sobriety betrayed the divided nature of the school, just as, in a different way, the two rivers that it straddled did. From the outside, the buildings were reticent, severe straight lines of red brick or white clapboard, with shutters standing sentinel beside each window, and a few unassuming white cupolas placed here and there on the roofs because they were expected and not pretty, like pilgrim bonnets. But once you pass through the colonial doorways, with only an occasional fan window or low-relief pillar to suggest that a certain muted adornment was permissible, you entered an extravaganza of pompadour splendor. Pink marble walls and white marble floors were enclosed by arched and vaulted ceilings. An assembly room had been done in the manner of high Italian Renaissance. Another was illuminated by chandeliers flashing with crystal teardrops. There was a wall of fragile French windows overlooking an Italian garden of marble bric-a-brac. The library was Provençal on the first floor, Rococo on the second. And everywhere, except in the dormitories, the floors and stairs were of smooth, slick marble, more treacherous than even the icy walks. "The winter loves me," he retorted. And then, disliking the whimsical sound of that, added, "I mean as much as you can say a season can love. What I mean is, I love winter. And when you really love something, then it loves you back in whatever way it has to love." I didn't think that this was true. My 17 years of experience had shown this to be much more false than true. But it was like every other thought and belief of Finney's. It should have been true. So I didn't argue. The boardwalk ended, and he moved a little ahead of me as we descended a sloping path toward our first class. He picked his way with surprising care, surprising in anyone who before used the ground mainly as a point of departure, as the given element in a suspended world of leaps in space. And now I remembered what I had never taken any special note of before, how Phineas used to walk. Around Devon we had gaits of every description, gangling shuffles from boys who had suddenly grown a foot taller, swinging cowboy lopes from those thinking of how wide their shoulders had become, ambles, waddles, light trippings, gigantic bunion strides. But Phineas had moved in continuous, flowing balance, so that he had seemed to drift along with no effort at all. Relaxation on the move. He hobbled now among the patches of ice. There was one certainty that Dr. Stanpole had given. Phineas would walk again. But the thought was there before me that he would never walk like that again. "Do you have a class?" he said as we reached the steps of the building. "Yes." "So do I." "Let's not go."
"Not go? What'll we use for an excuse?"
"We'll say I fainted from exertion on the way from chapel." He looked at me with a phantom smile. "And you had to tend me.
This is your first day back, Finney. You're no one to cut classes."
"I know, I know. I'm going to work. I really am going to work. You're going to pull me through mostly, but I am going to work as hard as I can. Only not today. Not the first thing. Not now. Not conjugating verbs when I haven't even looked at the school yet. I want to see this place. I haven't seen anything except the inside of our room and the inside of the chapel. I don't feel like seeing the inside of a classroom. Not now. Not yet. What do you want to see?"
He started to turn around so that his back was to me.
"Let's go to the gym," he said shortly.
The gym was at the other end of the school, a quarter of a mile away at least, separated from us by a field of ice. We set off without saying anything else. By the time we reached it, sweat was running like oil from Finney's face, and when he paused, involuntary tremors shook his hands and arms. The leg in its cast was like a sea anchor dragged behind. The illusion of strength I had seen in our room that morning must have been the same illusion he used at home to deceive his doctor and his family to sending him back to Devon. We stood on the ice-coated lawn in front of the gym while he got ready to enter it, resting himself so that he could go in with a show of energy. Later, this became his habit. I often caught up with him standing in front of a building, pretending to be thinking, or examining the sky, or taking off gloves. But it was never a convincing show. Phineas was a poor deceiver, having had no practice. We went into the gym, along a marble hallway, and to my surprise,
We went on past the trophy room, where his name was already inscribed on one cup, one banner, and one embalmed football. I was sure that this was his goal, to mull over these lost glories. I had prepared myself for that, and even thought of several positive, uplifting aphorisms to cheer him up. But he went by without a thought, down a stairway, steep in marble, and into the locker room. I went along, mystified, beside him. There was a pile of dirty towels in the corner. Binny shoved them with a crutch.
"What is all this crap?" he muttered with a little smile. "About no maids!"
The locker room was empty at this hour. Row after row of dull, green lockers separated by wide wooden benches. The ceiling was hung with pipes. It was a drab room for Devon, dull green and brown and gray. But at the far end, there was a big marble archway, glistening white, which led to the pool. Finney sat down on a bench, struggled out of his sheep-lined winter coat, and took a deep breath of gymnasium air. No locker room could have more pungent air than Devon's. Sweat predominated, but it was richly mingled with smells of paraffin and singed rubber, of soaked wool and liniment, and for those who could interpret it, of exhaustion, lost hope and triumph, and bodies battling against each other. I thought it anything but a bad smell. It was preeminently the smell of the human body after it had been used to the limit. Such a smell has meaning and poignance for any athlete, just as it has for any lover. Phineas looked down here and there, at the exercise bar over a sandpit next to the wall, at a set of weights on the floor, at a rolled-up wrestling mat, at a pair of spiked shoes kicked under a locker.
"Same old place, isn't it?"
he said, turning to me and nodding slightly. After a moment, I answered in a quiet voice, "Not exactly." He made no pretense of not understanding me. After a pause, he said,
"You're going to be the big star now,"
in an optimistic tone, and then added with some embarrassment,
"You can fill any gaps or anything."
He slapped me on the back.
"Get over there and chin yourself a few dozen times. What did you finally go out for anyway?"
"I finally didn't go out."
"You aren't." His eyes burned at me from his grimacing face. "Still the assistant senior crew manager."
"No, I quit that. I've just been going to gym classes, the ones they have for guys who aren't going out for anything." He wrenched himself around on the bench. Joking was past. His mouth widened irritably.
"What in hell?"
His voice bounded on the word in a sudden rich descent.
"Did you do that for?"
"It was too late to sign up for anything else." And seeing the energy to blast this excuse rushing into his face and neck, I stumbled on. "And anyway, with the war on, there won't be many trips for the teams." "I don't know. Sports don't seem so important with the war on."
"Have you swallowed all that war stuff?"
"No, of course I..." I was so committed to refuting him that I half denied the charge before I understood it. Now my eyes swung back to his face.
"All what war stuff?" "All that stuff about there being a war."
"I don't think I get what you mean."
"Do you really think that the United States of America is in a state of war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan?"
"Do I really think that..." My voice trailed off. He stood up, his weight on the good leg, the other resting lightly on the floor in front of him.
"Don't be a sap."
He gazed with cool self-possession at me.
"There isn't any war."
"I know why you're talking like this," I said, struggling to keep up with him. "Now I understand. You're still under the influence of some medicinal drug."
"No, you are. Everybody is."
He pivoted so that he was facing directly at me.
"That's what this whole war story is. A medicinal drug. Listen, did you ever hear of the Roaring Twenties?"
I nodded very slowly and cautiously.
"When they all drank bathtub gin and everybody who was young did just what they wanted?"
"Yes."
"Well, what happened was that they didn't like that, the preachers and the old ladies and all the stuffed shirts. So then they tried prohibition, and everybody just got drunker. So then they really got desperate and arranged the Depression. That kept the people who were young in the 30s in their place. but they couldn't use that trick forever. So for us, in the 40s, they cooked up this war fake.
Who are they, anyway?
The fat old men who don't want us crowding them out of their jobs. They've made it all up. There isn't any real food shortage, for instance. The men have all the best steaks delivered to their clubs now. You've noticed how they've been getting fatter lately, haven't you?
His tone took it thoroughly for granted that I had. For a moment, I was almost taken in by it. Then my eyes fell on the bound and cast white mask pointing at me. And, as it was always to do, it brought me down out of Finney's world of invention, down again as I had fallen after awakening that morning. Down to reality. To the facts.
Phineas, this is all pretty amusing and everything, but I hope you don't play this game too much with yourself. You might start to believe it, and then I'd have to make a reservation for you at the Funny Farm.
In a way, deep in argument, his eyes never wavered from mine, the whole world is on a Funny Farm now, but it's only the fat old men who get the joke.
And you?
Yes, and me.
What makes you so special? Why should you get it and all the rest of us be in the dark?
The momentum of the argument abruptly broke from his control. His face froze.
Because I've suffered, he burst out.
We drew back in amazement from this. In the silence, all the flighty spirits of the morning ended between us. He sat down, turned his flushed face away from me. I sat next to him, without moving for as long as my beating nerves would permit. And then I stood up and walked slowly toward anything which presented itself. It turned out to be the exercise bar. I sprang up, grabbed it, and then, in a fumbling and perhaps grotesque offering to Phineas, I chinned myself. I couldn't think of anything else. Not the right words, not the right gesture. I did what I could think of.
"Do 30 of them," he mumbled in a bored voice.
I had never done 10 of them. At the 12th, I discovered that he had been counting to himself because he began to count aloud in a non-committal, half-heard voice. At 18, there was a certain enlargement in his tone, and at 23, the last edges of boredom left it. He stood up, and the urgency with which he brought out the next numbers was like an invisible boost lifting me the distance of my arms, until he sang out, 30! With a flare of pleasure. The moment was past. Phineas, I know, had been even more startled than I to discover this bitterness in himself. Neither of us ever mentioned it again, and neither of us ever forgot that it was there. He sat down and studied his clenched hands.
"Did I ever tell you," he began in a husky tone, "that I used to be aiming for the Olympics?"
He wouldn't have mentioned it, except that after what he had said, he had to say something very personal, something deeply held. To do otherwise, to begin joking, would have been a hypocritical denial of what had happened, and Phineas was not capable of that. I was still hanging from the bar. My hands felt as though they had sunk into it.
"No, you never told me that,"
I mumbled into my arm.
"Well, I was. And now I'm not sure. Not 100% sure I'll be completely, you know, in shape by 1944. So I'm going to coach you for them instead."
"But there isn't going to be any Olympics in 44. That's only a couple of years away. The war.
Leave your fantasy life out of this. We're grooming you for the Olympics, pal, in 1944.
And not believing him. Not forgetting that troops were being shuttled toward battlefields all over the world. I went along, as I always did with any new invention of Finney's. There was no harm in taking aim, even if the target was a dream. But since we were so far out of the line of fire, the chief sustenance for any sense of the war was mental. We saw nothing real of it. All of our impressions of the war were in the false medium of two dimensions. Photographs in the newspapers and magazines, newsreels, posters, or artificially conveyed to us by a voice on the radio or headlines across the top of a newspaper. I found that only through a continuous use of the imagination I could hold out against Finney's driving offensive in favor of peace. And now, when we were served chicken livers for dinner,
I couldn't help conceiving a mental picture of President Roosevelt and my father and Finney's father and a number of other large old men sitting down to porterhouse steaks in some elaborate but secluded men's secret society room. When a letter from home told me that a trip to visit relatives had been canceled because of gas rationing, it was easy to visualize my father smiling silently with knowing eyes. At least as easy as it was to imagine an American force crawling through the jungles of a place called Guadalcanal. "Wherever that is," as Phineas said. And when in chapel, day after day, we were exhorted to new levels of self-deprivation and hard work, with the war as their justification, it was impossible not to see the faculty were using the excuse to drive us as they had always wanted to drive us, regardless of any war or peace. What a joke if Finney was right after all! But of course, I didn't believe him. I was too well protected against the great fear of boys' school life, which was to be taken in. Along with everyone else, except a few professional gulls, such as Leper, I rejected anything that had the smallest possibility of doubt about it. So, of course, I didn't believe him. But one day, after our chaplain, Mr. Carhart, had become very moved by his own sermon in chapel about God in the foxholes, I came away thinking that if Finney's opinion of the war was unreal, Mr. Carhart's was at least as unreal. But, of course, I didn't believe him. And anyway, I was too occupied to think about it all. In addition to my own work, I was dividing my time between tutoring Finney in studies and being tutored by him in sports. Since so much of learning anything depends on the atmosphere in which it was taught, Finney and I, to our joint double amazement, began to make flashing progress where we had been bumblers before. Mornings we got up at 6 to run. I dressed in a gym sweatsuit with a towel tucked around my throat, and Finney in pajamas, ski boots, and his sheep-lined coat. A morning shortly before Christmas vacation brought my reward. I was to run the course Finney had laid out, 4 times around an oval walk which circled the headmaster's home, a large, rambling, doubtfully colonial white mansion. Next to the house, there was a patriarchal elm tree, against the trunk of which Finney leaned and shouted at me as I ran a large circle around him. The plain of snow shone a powdery white that morning. The sun blazed icily, somewhere too low on the horizon to be seen directly. But its clean rays shed a blue-white glimmer all around us. The northern sunshine seemed to pick up faint particles of whiteness floating in the air and powdering the sleek blue sky. Nothing stirred. The bare arching branches of the elm seemed laid into this motionless sky. As I ran, the sound of my footfalls was pitched off short in the vast, immobile dawn, as though there was no room amid so many glittering sights for any sound to intrude. The figure of Phineas was set against the bulk of the tree. He shouted now and then, but these sounds, too, were quickly absorbed and dispelled. And he needed to give no advice that morning. After making 2 circuits of the walk, every trace of energy was, as usual, completely used up. And as I drove myself on, all my scattered aches found their usual way to a profound seat of pain in my side. My lungs, as usual, were fed up with all this work, and from now on would only go rackingly through the motions. My knees were boneless again, ready any minute to let my lower legs telescope up into the thighs. My head felt as though different sections of the cranium were grinding into each other. Then, for no reason at all, I felt magnificent. It was as though my body, until that instant, had simply been lazy, as though the aches and exhaustion were all imagined, created from nothing in order to keep me from truly exerting myself. Now my body seemed at last to say, "Well, if you must have it, here." And an accession of strength came flooding through me. Buoyed up, I forgot my usual feeling of routine self-pity when working out. I lost myself. Oppressed mind along with aching body, all entanglements were shed. I broke into the clear. After the 4th circuit, like sitting in a chair, I pulled up in front of Phineas. "You're not even winded," he said. "I know." "You found your rhythm, didn't you, that 3rd time around, just as you came into the straight part there?" "Yes, right there." "You've been pretty lazy all along, haven't you?" "Yes, I guess I have been."
You didn't even know anything about yourself.
I don't guess I did, in a way.
Well,
he gathered the sheepskin collar around his throat.
Now you know. And stop talking like a Georgia cracker. Don't guess I did.
Despite this jibe, he was rather impersonal toward me. He seemed older that morning, and leaning quietly against the great tree wrapped in his heavy coat, he seemed smaller, too. Or perhaps it was only that I, inside the same body, had felt myself all at once grown bigger. We proceeded slowly back to the dormitory. On the steps going in, we met Mr. Ludsberry coming out.
"I've been watching you from my window,"
he said in his hooting voice with a rare trace of personal interest.
"What are you up to, Forrester? Training for the commandos?"
There was no rule explicitly forbidding exercise at such an hour, but it was not expected. Ordinarily, therefore, Mr. Ludsberry would have disapproved. But the war had modified even his standards. All forms of physical exercise had become conventional for the duration. I mumbled some abashed answer, but it was Phineas who made the clear response.
"He's developing into a real athlete," he said matter-of-factly. "We're aiming for the 44 Olympics."
Mr. Ludsberry emitted a single chuckle from deep in his throat. Then his face turned brick red momentarily, and he assumed his customary sententiousness.
"Games are all right in their place," he said. "And I won't bore you with the Eton playing field's observation, but all exercise today is aimed, of course, at the approaching Waterloo. Keep that in your sights at all times, won't you?"
Finney's face set in determination, with the older look that I had just detected in him.
"No,"
he said. I don't believe any student had ever said no flatly to Mr. Ludsberry before. It flustered him uncontrollably. His face turned brick red again, and for a moment I thought he was going to run away. Then he said something so rapid, throaty, and clipped that neither of us understood it, turned quickly, and strode off across the quadrangle.
"He's really sincere. He thinks there's a war on," said Finney in simple wonder. "Now why wouldn't he know?"
He pondered Mr. Ludsberry's exclusion from the plot of the fat old men as we watched his figure, reedy even in his winter wraps, move away from us. Then the light broke.
"Oh, of course," he cried. "Too thin! Of course!"
I stood there, pitying Mr. Ludsberry for his fatal thinness, and reflecting that, after all, he had always had a gullible side. Chapter 9. This was my first, but not my last, lapse into Finney's vision of peace. For hours, and sometimes for days, I fell without realizing it into the private explanation of the world. Not that I ever believed that the whole production of World War II was a trick of the eye, manipulated by a bunch of calculating fat old men, appealing though this idea was. What deceived me was my own happiness. For peace is indivisible, and the surrounding world confusion found no reflection inside me. So I ceased to have any real sense of it. This was not shaken, even by the enlistment of Leper Lepelier. In fact, that made the war seem more unreal than ever. No real war could draw Leper voluntarily away from his snails and beaver dams. His enlistment seemed just another of Leper's vagaries, such as the time he slept on top of Mount Katahdin in Maine, where each morning the sun first strikes United States territory. On that morning, satisfying one of his urges to participate in nature, Leper Lepelier was the first thing the rising sun struck in the United States. Early in January, when we had all just returned from the Christmas holidays, a recruiter from the United States ski troops showed a film to the senior class in the Renaissance room. To Leper, it revealed what all of us were seeking, a recognizable and friendly face to the war. Skiers in white shrouds winged down virgin slopes, silent as angels, and then, realistically, herringboned up again, but herringboned in cheerful, sunburnt bands, with clear eyes and white teeth and chests full of vigor-laden mountain air. It was the cleanest image of the war I had ever seen. Even the Air Force, reputedly so high above the infantry's mud, was stained with axle grease by comparison, and the Navy was vulnerable to scurvy. Nothing tainted these white warriors of winter as they swooped down their spotless mountainsides, and this cool, clean response to the war glided straight into Lepper's Vermont heart. "How do you like that?" he whispered to me in a wondering voice during these scenes. "How do you like that?"
"You know, I think these are pictures of Finnish ski troops," Phineas whispered on the other side. "And I want to know when they start shooting our allies, the Bolsheviks, unless that war between them was a fake too, which I'm pretty sure it was."
After the movie ended and the lights came on to illuminate the murals of Tuscany and the painted classical galleries around us, Lepper still sat amazed in his folding chair. Ordinarily, he talked little, and the number of words which came from him now indicated that this was a turning point in his life.
"You know what? Now I see what racing skiing is all about. It's all right to miss seeing the trees and the countryside and all the other things when you've got to be in a hurry. And when you're in a war, you've got to be in a hurry, don't you? So I guess maybe racing skiers weren't ruining the sport after all. They were preparing it, if you see what I mean, for the future. Everything has to evolve or else it perishes."
Finney and I stood up, and Lepper looked earnestly from one to the other of us from his chair.
"Take the housefly. If it hadn't developed all those split-second reflexes, it would have become extinct long ago."
"You mean it adapted itself to the fly swatter?" queried Phineas.
"That's right. And skiing had to learn to move just as fast, or it would have been wiped out by this war."
"Yes, sir.
You know what? I'm almost glad this war came along. It's like a test, isn't it? And only the things and the people who've been evolving the right way survive."
You usually listen to Lepper's quiet talking with half a mind, but this theory of his brought me to close attention. How did it apply to me, to Phineas? And most of all, how did it apply to Lepper?
"I'm going to enlist in these ski troops," he went on mildly,
so unemphatically that my mind went back to half-listening. Threats to enlist that winter were always declaimed, like Brinker's, with a grinding of back teeth and flashing of eyes. I had already heard plenty of them. But only Lepper's was serious. A week later, he was gone. He had been within a few weeks of his 18th birthday, and with it, all chance of enlistment, of choosing a service, rather than being drafted into one, would have disappeared. The ski movie had decided him.
"I always thought the war would come for me when it wanted me," he said when he came to say goodbye the last day. "I never thought I'd be going to it. I'm really glad I saw that movie in time. You bet I am."
Then, as the Devon School's first recruit to World War II, he went out my doorway with his white stocking cap bobbing behind. It probably would have been better for all of us if someone like Brinker had been the first to go. He could have been depended upon to take a loud, dramatic departure, so that the school would have reverberated for weeks afterward with Brinker's last words, Brinker's military bearing, Brinker's sense of duty. And all of us, influenced by the vacuum of his absence, would have felt the touch of war as a daily fact. But the disappearing tale of Lepper's cap inspired none of this. For a few days, the war was more unimaginable than ever. We didn't mention it, and we didn't mention Lepper, until at last Brinker found a workable point of view. One day in the butt room, he read aloud a rumor in the newspaper about an attempt on Hitler's life. He lowered the paper, gazed in a visionary way in front of him, and then remarked, "That was Lepper, of course." This established our liaison with World War II. The Tunisian campaign became Lepper's liberation. The bombing of the Ruhr was greeted by Brinker with hurt surprise.
"He didn't tell us he'd left the ski troops."
The torpedoing of the Scharnhorst,
"At it again."
Lepper sprang up all over the world at the core of every Allied success. We talked about Leper's stand at Stalingrad, Leper on the Burma Road, Leper's convoy to Archangel. We surmised that the crisis over the leadership of the Free French would be resolved by the appointment of neither de Gaulle nor Giraud, but Lapellier. We knew, better than the newspapers, that it was not the Big Three, but the Big Four who were running the war. In the silences between jokes about Leper's glories, we wondered whether we ourselves would measure up to the humblest minimum standard of the army. I didn't know everything there was to know about myself, and I knew I didn't know it. I wondered in the silences between jokes about Leper whether the still hidden parts of myself might contain the sad sack, the outcast, or the coward. We were all at our funniest about Leper, and we all secretly hoped that Leper, that incompetent, was as heroic as we said. Everyone contributed to this legend, except Phineas. At the outset, with the attempt on Hitler's life, Phineas had said, "If someone gave Leper a loaded gun and put it at Hitler's temple, he'd miss." There was a general shout of outrage, and then we recommended the building of Leper's triumphal arch around Brinker's keystone. Phineas took no part in it, and since little else was talked about in the butt room, he soon stopped going there, and stopped me from going as well. "How do you expect to be an athlete if you smoke like a forest fire?" He drew me increasingly away from the butt room crowd, away from Brinker and Chet and all the other friends, into a world inhabited by just himself and me, where there was no war at all, just Phineas and me alone among all the people of the world training for the Olympics of 1944. Saturday afternoons are terrible in a boys' school, especially in the winter. There is no football game. It is not possible, as it is in the spring, to take bike trips into the surrounding countryside. Not even the most grinding student can feel required to lose himself in his books, since there is Sunday ahead, long, lazy, quiet Sunday, to do any homework. But these Saturdays are worst in the late winter, when the snow has lost its novelty and its shine, and the school seems to have been reduced to only a network of drains. During the brief thaw in the early afternoon, there is a dismal gurgling of dirty water seeping down pipes and along gutters, a gray, seamy shifting beneath the crust of snow, which cracks to show patches of frozen mud beneath. Shrubbery loses its bright snow headgear and stands bare and frail, too undernourished to hide the drains it was intended to hide. These are the days when going into any building you cross a mat of dirt and cinders let in by others before you, thinning and finally trailing off in the corridors. The sky is an empty, hopeless gray and gives the impression that this is its eternal shade. Winter's occupation seems to have conquered, overrun, and destroyed everything, so that now there is no longer any resistance movement left in nature. All the juices are dead, every sprig of vitality snapped, and now winter itself, an old, corrupt, tired conqueror, loosens its grip on the desolation, recedes a little, grows careless in its watch. Sick of victory and enfeebled by the absence of challenge, it begins itself to withdraw from the ruined countryside. The drains alone are active. And on these Saturdays, their noises sound a dull recessional to winter. Only Phineas failed to see what was so depressing. Just as there was no war in his philosophy, there was also no dreary weather. As I have said, all weathers delighted Phineas.
"You know what we better do next Saturday?"
he began in one of his voices, the low-pitched and even melodic one, which for some reason always reminded me of a Rolls-Royce moving along a highway.
"We'd better organize the winter carnival."
We were sitting in our room on either side of the single large window framing a square of featureless gray sky. Phineas was resting his cast, which was a considerably smaller one now, on the desk and thoughtfully pressing designs into it with a pocket knife.
"What winter carnival?" I asked.
"The winter carnival. The Devon Winter Carnival."
"There isn't any Devon Winter Carnival, and never has been."
"There is now. We'll have it at that park next to the Nequamset. The main attraction will be sports, naturally, featuring, I expect, a ski jump.
A ski jump? That park is as flat as a pancake.
And some slalom races, and I think a little track. But we've got to have some snow statues, too, and a little music, and something to eat. Now, which committee do you want to head?
I gave him a wintry smile.
The Snow Statues Committee.
I knew you would. You always were secretly arty, weren't you? I'll organize the sports. Brinker can handle the music and food. And then we need somebody to kind of beautify the place. A few holly wreaths and something like that. Someone good with plants and shrubbery. I know. Leper.
From looking at the star he was imprinting in his cast, I looked quickly up at his face.
Leper's gone. Oh, yeah, so he is. Leper would be gone. Well, somebody else, then.
And because it was Finney's idea, it happened, as he said, although not as easily as some of his earlier inspirations. For our dormitory was less enthusiastic about almost everything with each succeeding week. Brinker, for example, had begun a long, decisive sequence of withdrawals from school activity ever since the morning I deserted his enlistment plan. He had not resented my change of heart. In fact, had immediately undergone one himself. If he could not enlist, and for all his self-sufficiency, Brinker could not do much without company. He could at least cease to be so multifariously civilian. So he resigned the presidency of the Golden Fleece Debating Society, stopped writing his school spirit column for the newspaper, dropped the chairmanship of the underprivileged local children's subcommittee of the Good Samaritan Confraternity, stilled his baritone in the chapel choir, and even, in his most impressive burst of irresponsibility, resigned from the Student Advisory Committee to the headmaster's discretionary benevolent fund. His well-bred clothes had disappeared. These days he wore khaki pants, supported by a garrison belt, and boots which rattled when he walked.
"Who wants a winter carnival?"
he said in the disillusioned way he had lately developed when I brought it up.
"What are we supposed to be celebrating?"
"Winter, I guess."
"Winter?"
He gazed out of his window at the vacant sky and seeping ground.
"Frankly, I don't see anything to celebrate. Winter or spring or anything else."
"This is the first time Finney's gotten going on anything since..." he came back.
"He has been kind of non-functional, hasn't he? He isn't brooding, is he?"
"No, he wouldn't brood."
"No, I don't suppose he would. Well, if you think it's something Finney really wants... Still, there's never been a winter carnival here. I think there's probably a rule against it."
"I see," I said in the tone which made Brinker raise his eyes and lock them with mine. In that plotter's glance, all his doubts vanished, for Brinker, the lawgiver, had turned rebel for the duration. The Saturday was battleship gray. Throughout the morning, equipment for the winter carnival had been spirited out of the dormitory and down to the small, incomplete public park on the bank of the Neguamset River. Brinker supervised the transfer, rattling up and down the stairwell and giving orders. He made me think of a pirate captain disposing of the booty. Several jugs of very hard cider, which he had browbeaten away from some lower classman, were the most cautiously guarded treasure. They were buried in the snow near a clump of evergreens in the center of the park, and Brinker stationed his roommate, Brownie Perkins, to guard them with his life. He meant this literally, and Brownie knew it. So he trembled alone there in the middle of the park for hours, wondering what would happen if he had an attack of appendicitis, unnerved by thoughts of a fainting spell, horrified by the realization that he might have to move his bowels, until at last we came. Then Brownie crept back to the dormitory, too exhausted to enjoy the carnival at all. On this day of high illegal competitiveness, no one noticed. The buried cider was half-consciously plotted at the hub of the carnival. Around it sprang up large, sloppy statues, easily modeled because of the snow's dampness. Nearby, entirely out of place in this snowscape, like a dowager in a saloon, there was a heavy, circular classroom table, carried there by superhuman exertions the night before, on Finney's insistence that we had to have something to display the prizes on. On it rested the prizes. Finney's icebox, hidden all these months in the dormitory basement. A Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, with all the most stimulating words marked. A set of York barbells. The Iliad, with English translation of each sentence written above it. Brinker's file of Betty Grable photographs. A lock of hair, cut under duress from the head of Hazel Brewster, the professional town bell. A hand-woven rope ladder, with a proviso that it should be awarded to someone occupying a room on the third floor or higher. A forged draft registration card. And $4.13 from the headmaster's discretionary benevolent fund. Brinker placed this last prize on the table with such silent dignity that we all thought it was better not to ask any questions about it. Phineas sat behind the table in a heavily carved black walnut chair. The arms ended in two lion's heads, and the legs ended in paws gripping wheels now sunk in the snow. He had made the purchase that morning. Phineas bought things only on impulse and only when he had the money. And since the two states rarely coincided, his purchases were few and strange. Chet Douglas stood next to him, holding his trumpet. Finney had regretfully given up the plan of inviting the school band to supply music, since it would have spread news of our carnival to every corner of the campus. Chet, in any case, was an improvement over that cacophony. He was a slim, fair-skinned boy with a ball of curly auburn hair curving over his forehead. And he devoted himself to playing two things, tennis and the trumpet. He did both with such easy inborn skill that after observing him, I began to think that I could master either one any weekend I tried. Much like the rest of us, on the surface, he had an underlying obliging and considerate strain, which barred him from being a really important member of the class. You had to be rude at least sometimes, and edgy often, to be credited with personality, and without that accolade, no one at Devon could be anyone. No one, with the exception, of course, of Phineas. To the left of the prize table, Brinker straddled his cache of cider. Behind him was the clump of evergreens. Behind them there was, after all, a gentle rise where the ski jump committee was pounding snow into a little takeoff ramp, whose lip was perhaps a foot higher than the slope of the rise. From there, our line of snow statues, unrecognizable artistic attacks on the headmaster, Mr. Ludsbury, Mr. Patch Withers, Dr. Stanpole, the new dietitian, and Hazel Brewster, curved in an enclosing half-circle to the icy, muddy, lisping edge of the tidewater Neguamset and back to the other side of the prize table. When the ski jump was ready, there was a certain amount of milling around. 20 boys, tightly reined in all winter, stood now as though with the bit firmly clamped between their teeth, ready to stampede. Phineas should have started the sports events, but he was absorbed in cataloging the prizes. All eyes swung next upon Brinker. He had been holding a pose above his cider of Gibraltar invulnerability. He continued to gaze challengingly around him until he began to realize that wherever he looked, calculating eyes looked back.
All right," he said roughly. "Let's get started."
The ragged circle around him moved perceptibly closer.
"Let's get going," he yelled. "Come on, Finney, what's first?"
Phineas had one of those minds which could record what was happening in the background and do nothing about it because something else was preoccupying him. He seemed to sink deeper into his list.
"Phineas!"
Brinker pronounced his name with the maximum use of teeth.
"What is next?"
Still, the sleek brown head bent mesmerized over the list.
"What's the big hurry, Brinker?" someone from the tightening circle asked with dangerous gentleness. "What's the big rush?"
"We can't stand here all day," he blurted. "We've got to get started if we're going to have this damn thing. What's next? Phineas!"
At last, the recording in Finney's mind reached its climax. He looked vaguely up, studied the straddling at-bay figure of Brinker at the core of the poised perimeter of boys, hesitated, blinked, and then, in his organ voice, said good-naturedly,
"Next?"
Well, that's pretty clear.
You are.
Chet released from his trumpet the opening, lifting, barbaric call of a bullfight, and the circle of boys broke wildly over Brinker. He flailed back against the evergreens, and the jugs appeared to spring out of the snow.
What the hell?
He kept yelling, off balance among the branches.
What the hell?
By then, his cider, which he had apparently expected to dole out according to his own governing whim, was disappearing. There was going to be no government, even by whim, even by Brinker's whim, on this Saturday at Devon. From a scramble of contenders, I got one of the jugs, elbowed off a counterattack, opened it, sampled it, choked, and then went through with my original plan by stopping Brinker's mouth with it. His eyes bulged and blood vessels in his throat began to pulsate until, at length, I lowered the jug. He gave me a long, pondering look, his face closed and concentrating, while behind it his mind plainly teetered between fury and hilarity. I think if I had batted an eye, he would have hit me. The carnival's breaking apart into a riot hung like a bomb between us. I kept on looking, expressionlessly, back at him until, beneath a blackening scowl, his mouth opened enough to fire out the words,
"I've been violated!"
I jerked the jug to my mouth and took a large gulp of cider in relief, and the violence latent in the day drifted away. Perhaps the Neguamsit carried it out on the receding tide. Brinker strode through the swirl of boys to Phineas.
"I formally declare," he bellowed, "that these games are open!"
"You can't do that," Finney said rebukingly. "Whoever heard of opening the games without the sacred fire from Olympus?"
Sensing that I must act as the chorus, I registered on my face the universally unheard-of quality of the games without fire.
"Fire! Fire!"
I said across the damp snow.
"We'll sacrifice one of the prizes," said Phineas, seizing the Iliad.
He sprinkled the pages with cider to make them more inflammable, touched a match to them, and a little jet of flame curled upward. The games, alight with Homer and cider, were open. Chet Douglas, leaning against the side of the prize table, continued to blow musical figures for his own enlightenment. Forgetful of us and the athletic programming Finney now put into motion, he strolled here and there, sometimes at the start of the ski jump competition, blowing an appropriate call, more often invoking the serene order of Haydn, or a high, remote, arrogant Spanish world, or the cheerful, low-down carelessness of New Orleans. The hard cider began to take charge of us. Or I wonder now whether it wasn't the cider, but our own exuberance which intoxicated us, sent restraint flying, causing Brinker to throw the football block on the statue of the headmaster, giving me, as I put on the skis and slid down the small slope, and off the miniature ski jump, a sensation of soaring flight, of hurtling high and far through space, inspiring Phineas, during one of Chet's Spanish inventions, to climb onto the prize table and with only one leg to create a droll dance among the prizes, springing and spinning from one bare space to another, cleanly missing Hazel Brewster's hair, never marring by a misstep the pictures of Betty Grable. Under the influence not, I know, of the hardest cider, but of his own inner joy of life, for a moment as it should be, as it was meant to be in his nature, Phineas recaptured that magic gift for existing primarily in space, one foot conceding briefly to gravity its rights before spinning him off again into the air. It was his wildest demonstration of himself in the kind of world he loved. It was his choreography of peace. And when he stopped and sat down among the prizes and said,
"And now we're going to have the decathlon. Quiet, everybody! Our Olympic candidate, Gene Forrester, is now going to qualify."
It wasn't the cider which made me in this moment champion of everything he ordered, to run as though I were the abstraction of speed, to walk the half-circle of statues on my hands, to balance on my head, on top of the icebox, on top of the prize table,
to jump, if he asked it, across the Nagwamset and land crashing in the middle of Quackenbush's boathouse, to accept at the end of it amid a clatter of applause, for on this day even the schoolboy egotism of Devon was conjured away, a wreath made from the evergreen trees which Phineas placed on my head. It wasn't the cider which made me surpass myself. It was this